I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. All this week, VPR has been airing and putting online a special series called Gunshots. A team of people at the station and other volunteers combed through death certificates provided by the Vermont Department of Health between January 2011 and December 2016 and compiled a database of every gun death in Vermont. The number is 420. 420 deaths in those 6 years where the primary or secondary cause of death was a gunshot wound. From those numbers, we've seen trends. We know ages, gender, whether or not the person was married or employed. The vast majority of those deaths were suicides. Military veterans make up a significant and overrepresented proportion of them. There's a lot we don't know, too. Mental health status, a history of domestic violence, the person's relationship to guns. And we don't know the individual circumstances of each of these deaths and the hearts broken by those who are left behind. It's important to remember that behind every number is not just one person, but a constellation of people whose lives have been inalterably changed. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to explore the series and what we've learned from the data our team compiled, which, by the way, you can explore in great detail yourself. Go to vpr.net to find the series and the raw data. I'm joined this hour by Taylor Dobbs, the producer of VPR's Gunshot series. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, Jane.
And we really want to hear from you this hour. While the jumping-off point for our series was the record of gun deaths in the state, we've used those statistics to explore our relationship with guns, the role firearms play in Vermont culture, and how many different perspectives there are on how we should think about and potentially regulate guns. Now, this is not going to be a debate over gun laws on the show today. We want to explore this relationship. Regulation comes into it for sure, but I invite you to think philosophically, personally. Share your thoughts. Share your questions. My hope for this hour is that we can work on empathy and understanding and maybe go a little deeper than we often are able to get to on a show about such a contentious topic. Let's hear a couple voices here before we really dive into the data. Hannah Romer, a music teacher and orchestra conductor in Hanover, New Hampshire, grew up in rural southern Vermont. She reached out to us about her father, one of the 373 Vermonters who died by gun-related suicide between 2011 and 2016. Here's some of her commentary that aired on VPR.
Before this experience, I had never really felt strongly about gun laws. I know lots of people who have guns for hunting or farming or dealing with woodchucks in the garden, but no one in my family owns guns, and I didn't think much about them. But my perspective was really shattered by my dad's suicide and the violence involved. Following his death, I was appalled to learn how easy it is for someone like my dad to buy a firearm in Vermont. He bought the gun in a local shop 10 days before his death. He had a well-documented clinical history of mental illness and suicidality, but no criminal record, so his background check was clear. It's hard to believe that individuals like my father in psychological crisis have nothing preventing them from buying a gun, except having to hand some money over the counter.
That was Hannah Romer, and you can hear her commentary on our website. When asked what role guns played in his life, Eric Hodette of West Fairleigh reflected on the regional differences he's experienced as he's moved around the state.
So I grew up in the northern part of the state and seemed to be very, very gun-friendly. You know, not necessarily like, oh, we have to have all sorts of guns. But if you had one, it wasn't really a big deal. People hunt and they, shoot for sport and things like that. And then I lived in Burlington area for a few years, and it seemed to be much more, leaning more heavily on restrictions and regulations and where you can and can't have them. And if you have one somewhere, it becomes kind of more a big deal. And since then, I've actually moved out to the Upper Valley. And in this part of the state also, it is very kind of, relaxed. If you have one, you got a rifle rack on your truck or you have your everyday carry or whatever. Nobody really thinks twice about it.
Now, John Murray is a 27-year-old technician from Rutland, and when we asked what role guns play in Vermonters' lives, he shared his love of the history that fuels his passion for guns.
I mean, there's millions of different patterns of firearms, different histories, different stories. I have a favorite gun designer, and I have some samples of his early work, his later work, his collaborations. Like, if someone's, like, really big into the AR-15, they'd probably know Eugene Stoner designed the AR-15. Was originally the AR-10, chambered in a 76251, and then it was brought down to more intermediate cartridge. And then if you look at the bolt assembly on the AR-15, you can see, oh, that can be traced back to when he worked with Melvin Maynard Johnson on the 1941 Johnson rifle. And then you can start tracing things back, see who got their ideas from whom, how they were inspired by different things. Like, my favorite generation is 1930s to, like, 1950s.
There are so many perspectives on guns and the role they play in our individual lives and our collective culture. We're going to talk about it all this hour, and we're going to explore the data that the team came up with for our gunshot series. Jonathan Butler, VPR's Director of Digital Services and the data editor of the Gunshots Project, is in our control room. He's going to be compiling and looking at and crunching all the data in real time, so we have some fact-checking and data information going on as well. But Taylor Dobbs is here with me in the studio. He's the producer of the Gunshots Project. Taylor, what made you want to do this reporting in the first place?
Well, I think part of it was based on what you were just talking about. This is an incredibly contentious issue. I've been a reporter for a few years in Vermont, and gun control has come up a number of times in the State House. And I've noticed every time the arguments are very similar. A lot of the same types of statistics are used, and a lot of those statistics are national. And a lot of people on both sides, any side of the issue really, say that Vermont has a sort of different relationship with guns than the sort of national whole. So I was curious how Vermont's data bounces off of these political points, but also just how does the issue of gun violence affect Vermont specifically? Because we know that Vermont has a rich cultural history and, I mean, not just history. Right now, there's plenty of people who love hunting, target shooting, and that sort of thing. Also, home defense. So it was really
plenty of people who are really, just abhor guns as well.
Absolutely, and you have both of those things coexisting in Vermont. And it's easy to see that as a contradiction, but it's also the state we live in this moment. And so I just wanted to know more about kind of what is the issue of gun deaths actually look like in Vermont, who's most affected, kind of what's the profile of the incident when a gun death occurs, are there patterns in that? And so we asked the Vermont Department of Health for death certificates, because that's a public document that that would kind of contain a lot of the information that would answer some of those questions.
Yeah, you can't really, in terms of data, very easily get to questions about culture, and you can't answer all of those questions through the death certificates. But death certificates were sort of your closest proxy for something that resembled statistics that you could use to then jump off of that to explore this idea.
Right. And I mean, I think it's important to note that those statistics are very narrowly focused on the worst possible outcome when a gun is involved in any situation. And it's also important to note that that is a very small fraction of the interactions with guns in Vermont. So that was what we were focusing on, in part because that's what we could get to. There's very clear data. It is very straightforward that that's a public document. So we were able to get this data set and understand the death side of the story of guns in Vermont. But as you said, it's hard to use data to quantify culture or, the way people feel about them. So we also just kind of asked, we put a call out on Reddit, and we asked around just among commentators and tried to get a very wide view of how different Vermonters feel about guns to get at that culture question, because there's no data, but we can definitely ask around and hear what people have to say. And we heard some of those comments at the beginning of the show.
Diane says she grew up around guns, even though my family was not a typical deer hunting family. In fact, my best friend killed herself with one of her family's rifles as a teen. To me, Diane says, guns are weapons of mass destruction. I don't want them anywhere near me or those I love. Michael says, I grew up with them, and so do my children. Actively used to hunt, kept safely away, and ready to be used if that day ever comes. I watched my son shoot his first buck in northern Vermont last year. He respects the firearms for the dangerous tools they are. And Mike says that he grew up with them. He says, I did skeet and pistol shooting, went through basic ROTC training with them. Yes, there's an element of fun, but I also spent many years in the UK where handguns and automatic and semi-automatic weapons are illegal and long guns are strictly licensed. And I see no reason why the same should not apply here as well. Coming back to this country into an open carry state was both shocking and depressing. And Dan says, I received my first firearm when I was probably 10 to 12 years old. I used them for hunting and target shooting. All of my guns stay locked with the ammo in a separate location. So lots of different perspectives, Taylor, and I gather that you're hearing many different perspectives even as the series has been progressing this week.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of nuance in these comments. You just heard some of it where you have people who say, I grew up around guns. I love hunting. I go hunting all the time. Or maybe they have a gun for home defense or whatever. But they say, but also, I want to see different restrictions or, these types of guns, I'm not sure why they're allowed. You know, so you have people saying things like that. And then, of course, you have people saying the sort of tried and true things that happen when gun control comes up, where someone will just say that any form of gun control would be harmful and guns are an absolute right that Americans have. And then on people on the other side who say there's no role for guns in sort of civilian life. But I was struck by how much more nuance seemed to come out of the woodwork, where you really have people who have a positive relationship with guns in some way and also see problems around the way our society interacts with them. And it's very easy, especially, in online comment sections, to reduce all of that to a contradiction. But in fact, I think that's where a good chunk of the state is. And so part of this has been seeing that conversation come out and seeing people deal with, maybe they own a gun, they love to hunt, they have a family member who has died by suicide, and they have to sort of make sense of all of that and live their life. And I think that's an important part of this story.
That came up in the reporting that VPR's Liam Elder Connors did. And he spoke to Rutland gun shop owner John Cragen about what gun shop owners are and aren't able to do to prevent suicide. And when Liam was talking with John, it became very clear that for John, this isn't just an abstract issue.
I've had two very good friends of mine do it.
Really?
Yeah.
Did they use guns?
Both of them. And that's, that makes it harder for me, because we're around them all the time.
Yeah. How do you think about that? Like when those
but that was their choice, and it is what it is.
Yeah. So even a gun shop owner thinking, I have my own relationship with guns, but I also have a proximity to suicide. And, it's a very complicated issue. We're going to get into more calls, more details here. But Taylor, I would love for you to give us some of the stats, because that is what we use as some of the jumping off point here. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, 420 death certificates over 6 years in the state of Vermont that listed gunshots as the primary or secondary cause of death. What else do we know, though, beyond that number of 420?
Right. So that's the top line number. And part of this project was to get at that. But what we were really curious about is within that, who is dying and how are they dying and what's going wrong, as much as we can tell. And a lot of the stuff we can't tell because death certificates have a limited amount of information. But what we were able to determine, 89% of those deaths were deaths by suicide. So that's a really big number. The New York Times reported in the past that about just over 60% nationally of gun deaths are suicide. And so 89 in Vermont is really high and suggests that maybe in Vermont that's a bigger portion of the overall gun violence issue. And even within that, it was striking that the majority of all of those gun deaths over that period were caused by white men shooting themselves. So it was a really demographically similar group for the most part. And of course, there were homicides involved. There were 47 homicides over that period. And there were also people of color and women who died from gunshot wounds as well. But again, 339 of those people were white men killing themselves. And that was extremely striking and something that I really kind of didn't see coming when we requested this data.
Yeah, it's interesting, that question of suicide, and we're going to get into that, and we're going to also talk to people who have very personal stories about this. I'm cognizant every time we talk about statistics, certainly when we're talking about statistics of people who have died, that we're talking about real humans, real human beings, and as I said, real heartache and heartbreak for people, no matter what the circumstances are. But on those statistics, you can a couple of questions arise when it comes to suicides by gun. And the fact that 89% of the gun deaths in Vermont over that six-year period can be attributed to suicide can tell you a couple things. And it can raise questions about our suicide rate and average rate in Vermont. It could also suggest that when it comes to gun violence, there's not much, but what it is suicides. Do you have a sense of how our actual death by gunshot compares to the national average and how our suicide rate compares?
Well, as I said, there was that 60% rate in terms of the percentage of gun deaths that are suicide. So at
nationally,
the national level, that's
but
about 60%.
But that could suggest that gun violence and homicide is that much higher in other places. And so that's hard to know what it tells us about suicides.
Right. And so what we do know about suicide, and there's definitely more questions to be asked and answered that we don't have the answers for. But during this six-year period that we looked at, the majority of suicides in Vermont by any cause for each year were caused by guns. So it was definitely the majority of the suicide issue in Vermont. And the Department of Mental Health has said that the suicide rate in Vermont overall, again, this is not specifically guns, has gone up over the past 10 years. And is also somewhat above the national average. So that is an issue in Vermont, and it's definitely a huge part of the story of this data. But also, beyond firearms, suicide is something that is clearly part of this conversation, and beyond guns, and also then you get into the mental health questions, which we can't answer with this data because there's simply not medical history that's attached to death certificates. So we have no way of knowing a person's mental health history just by looking at a death certificate.
Today, we're talking with VPR reporter Taylor Dobbs, who's the producer of our special series, Gunshots, airing all this week on air and unfolding online at VPR.net. You can look at all the data on deaths in Vermont over the last 6 years where gunshots were a primary or secondary cause. In addition to exploring statistics, we're exploring our own assumptions, our own stories, and living with our own discomfort. Let's go to Martha, who's calling in from Castleton. Hi, Martha. You're on the air.
Hey, Jane. I love you. Thanks for all the great work that you do, for starters. And I just want to say, boy, you bit off a lot here. It's huge, enormous topic. And my son died by suicide with a shotgun. And he is one of the 420 deaths in the state of Vermont. And when you talk about mental illness and you talk about gun control, I almost want to say they're separate, even though the statistics of death by gunshot are so high. However, having guns around in people's trucks, hanging on the back of their trucks, seems like such loose gun control. Having semi-automatic weapons in people's homes seems ludicrous. But when you throw suicide into the mix, you know, suicide is mental illness. It's not, you know, they're not two separate things. You can't take your life if you're not suffering from mental illness. And so suicide prevention in and of itself, I think people who are going to commit suicide are going to commit suicide regardless of whether they have access to a gun or not. I guess that's my point. And I'm for stringent gun control. I mean, background checks, don't sell them at gun shows. But that being said, being the sufferer of a suicide, suicide prevention, mental health services, drug addiction, you know, just addiction in general, prevention and treatment, that deals with that majority of deaths of white men in Vermont.
Martha, I really appreciate you calling in, and I'm so very sorry to hear about your son. That's a horrible statistic to be a part of, and I appreciate you sharing your thoughts and your feelings about both gun control and mental health and suicide prevention, and how you feel in many ways those are separate things. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. I want to play you the thoughts of another mother, Valerie Pallotta. VPR spoke with her. Her son, Josh Pallotta, was a 25-year-old Vermont veteran of Afghanistan who committed suicide with a gun in 2014. And Valerie said, very similar to what you have said, Martha, that she doesn't think limiting Josh's access to guns would have made a difference.
I do think that Josh would have found another way. I think when a person is ready to end their life and end their pain, that they will find whatever means they can to do that.
In his reporting on gun suicides in Vermont, though, VPR's Liam Elder Connors spoke with Thomas Delaney, an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the Larner College of Medicine at the University of Vermont. Delaney studies suicide prevention and says that, in fact, studies show that it is often not true that someone attempting suicide will find another way if denied a lethal means like a gun.
So most of the people, and we know this from a few studies now, most of the people who survive even really serious attempts at taking their lives actually don't go on to die by suicide.
And because a suicidal crisis is often brief, Delaney says it's important that a person not have access to something that's really deadly, like a gun.
Firearms not really reversible. Once you make that decision, there's no opportunity to then go back, call 911 or call your counselor or whatever.
I'm here with Taylor Dobbs, a reporter for VPR and the producer of VPR's Gunshots Project. You know, we've heard from Martha, we heard from Valerie Pallotta, and we heard from Professor Delaney there about suicides. And Taylor, just reiterate the statistics. It's really striking. 89% of the deaths by gunshot that you found in Vermont over a six-year period were attributed to suicide.
That's right. And percentages can be kind of tough to actually get the human side of that. But that's 373 people who died by suicide over that six-year period. And again, 47 homicides in that same period involving firearms. And you mentioned that Valerie Pallotta and her son Josh, being a veteran, one of the most striking things that we found in this project is that of those 373 suicides, 114 people had served in the U.S. Armed Forces at some point in their life. That means maybe they were actively serving or they were a veteran. That's 31% of the deaths by suicide, which on its own is striking. But then if you look at the percentage of Vermont's population that's veterans, it's only 7%. So even though active duty is in there and that throws off the apples-to-apples comparison, 7% and 30% are really far apart. So there's some questions there as to how that number is so much higher among the veteran community and how that can be addressed.
So what are you hearing then from people who are looking into these issues about suicide prevention? You know, how much of it is related to having less access to guns and how much of it is related to better health care and better mental health care that is completely separate from guns and the lethal means of suicide, but goes really more towards helping people who are in distress? I mean, what do you hear about the balancing of those equations?
Well, in Liam's reporting, some of which you just played, Thomas Delaney, again, he's talking about how if you can intervene in that period of intense crisis where someone is at risk of suicide, they ultimately are much more likely to go on and not die by suicide. So those interventions and the mental help that people can get when they need it, it really, really does matter according to the science behind this. And people are really saying, you know, there's a lot that can be done short of taking somebody's gun away or, you know, putting restrictions on ownership. Liam talked to some folks at Howard Center. Their caseworkers literally drive around with cable locks in their cars so people can put a cable lock through their gun that makes it impossible to fire without unlocking it. That's not taking the gun away, and it's not even saying, hey, hide the key from the person who's struggling with mental illness. It just makes it a little bit harder to, in this intense moment, heat of the moment, pick up a gun and do something that is irreversible. So there's a lot of effort into safe storage, like locking guns up. And also, you know, one of the most striking pieces of advice was from reporting by Annie Russell and Henry Epp on the issue of veteran suicides. And one thing they say at the VA is for veterans to store a photo of a loved one near where they store their gun, which when you think about the situation that they're trying to predict is just so powerful. But it also shows that there's things that can be done short of – they're not saying sell your guns off, get rid of them, never own a gun, never be around guns. They recognize that a lot of people, that's non-negotiable for them. And there are things you can do to prevent the risks of suicide even without some massive shift in legislation or gun culture.
I once was speaking with Chief Hanley, the chief of police in Middlebury, Vermont, and we were talking about gun storage for a story that I did. And he said, you know, sometimes families will bring a gun to us at the police department and say, can you store this for me? We need it to be out of our house for a period of time. You know, sometimes it was unrelated to mental health conditions. It might be we're going away for a year or we're going on vacation and we're worried about just having it in our house. But sometimes it might be we have a family member or we have a young person in our household and we don't want that gun around us. And he said, yeah, we store it for them and then we give it back to them, you know, provided it's not evidence in a crime. It's their gun. We give it back to them when they request it. But we sometimes take these guns in for safe storage when it's not something that's safe for a family to have around. We got a note from Jeff who says, you wouldn't let a blind person drive a car. Why would you let a person with mental challenges have a gun? Guns should be controlled in the same way cars are, training, licensing, and relicensing, and reevaluating based on health. I used to hunt and have guns until I was shot at in the woods bow hunting. Steve says, folks, keep in mind that Vermont and especially Windsor have played major roles in the evolution of American firearms. The Hilliard rifle in the mid-19th century developed in Windsor introduced the concept of mass production of rifles, which up to that time were handcrafted. Hilliard and other Windsor rifle makers advanced the concept of interchangeable parts, a key element in the manufacture of modern weaponry. Another note here from John in Richmond who says, even though suicide by guns is a problem, people trying to kill themselves on Vermont roads are killing other innocent people, too. Last year, we had several deaths of innocent people on I-89. And certainly, no one trying to suggest that suicide by other means aren't also just as deadly and just as awful. Joy is calling in from Thetford Center. Hi, Joy. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just have 2 points. One is that I just cannot understand why gun safety is not being discussed in our country as a public health safety issue. And second, whenever I hear Vermont public officials talking about guns, I hear, and I quote, Vermont is a safe state, to which I always think and want to tell them that those children at Sandy Hook that fateful day, they did not feel unsafe going into school that day. So we're only safe until we're not. Thank you.
Joy, before you hang up, so what is it that you would like to see?
Well, you know, in terms of I've just heard the number that 20,000 people a year die from opioids, and that's the same number of people that are dying by guns. And people are willing to have a conversation about opioids. When people die from texting and driving, we can talk about that. You know, I just don't understand why, as soon as you talk about guns, there's the two sides. There's it gets political. Why can't we say, hey, people are dying, how can, you know, why can't we work together? There's groups like Gun Sense Vermont, which, you know, I'm involved with, that want to work with people that are gun owners and that believe that they have the right to hunt. And it just seems like that we need to have this conversation like the one that you're trying to get going today, which I really appreciate.
Joy, thank you. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts on this. Taylor, this is, I know for you, one of the main questions that you have that we didn't really get at in the reporting, but this is a preoccupation for you about why when we start to have conversations about guns, it really suddenly becomes so polarized. And here's Joy saying, we have conversations about other terrible things that happen, and yet we don't talk about gun deaths in the same way. We don't talk about safe regulation of firearms. Why do you think it's so politically fraught?
You know, it's that. I mean, that's definitely one of the curiosities that sort of got me thinking about this project because I was aware, as Joy mentioned, you know, we're very aware of opiate deaths in Vermont. It's very easy to go online and figure out how many people died from opiates in Vermont over the same time period. When you looked at gun statistics, it wasn't really there. And that's not to say that one problem is bigger than the other, but it felt like they weren't even being talked about as sort of problems of similar size in terms of the amount of people dying. And we now know that they are comparable. They're not the same, but that conversation politically looks very differently when you bring up preventing gun deaths than when you bring up preventing opiate deaths, which outnumber gun deaths in Vermont, I believe, and traffic deaths, which, you know, when we were looking at this, we wanted to put some of these numbers in perspective. One thing that really struck me was, again, there were 373 suicides involving firearms during that six-year period. Statewide, there were 370 traffic deaths. So we just heard from Governor Scott this week. There's a conversation that he's trying to start about traffic safety and highway safety, and that's absolutely important because people are dying, and that needs to be addressed. I think it's really interesting to hold up the rhetoric involved with that discussion against the really absence of any conversation or rhetoric around firearms deaths in Vermont. And, you know, not to suggest that there's a solution here, but people don't seem to even talk or think about these things in the same way. And, I'm really not sure if I can say why that is, but I think holding these numbers up side by side and saying 370 traffic deaths, 373 gun suicides, 370 traffic deaths, what are we doing to address both of these problems?
We got a note from Nate who says, when this discussion comes up, people who do not own guns, typically from urban backgrounds, are quick to throw up ideas of more laws that create unnecessary difficulties for law-abiding gun owners. The reason these arguments quickly become contentious is that the right to bear arms is a constitutional right. Nate says, my perspective as a gun owner is that if we're concerned about suicide and crime, we should focus on the causes, not the tool. Shifting the focus away from the root causes and towards the tool is a band-aid approach. VPR's Taylor Dobbs is with me today, and we are exploring the role guns play in Vermont culture, as well as looking at gun violence, specifically the 420 recorded deaths by gunshot between 2011 and 2016. Taylor is the producer of the VPR series Gunshots, which starts with the statistics and goes deep into issues of suicide and suicide prevention, gun culture, and gun violence. We're trying to have a conversation here with you, with Vermont, about guns, and I hope you'll share your thoughts and contribute to that conversation. You can do it at vpr.net, where you can find all the data from the Gunshots series, as well as all of the stories. There's a lot to read, listen to, and think about there. Guy wrote in to say, a gun is a tool, no more than that. A car is a tool. It can cause damage to a person, even kill. We lost 7 in Vermont in a 24-hour period last week due to cars. My guns do not have brains. They're cold. They have no feelings. My right to carry and own guns is given to me by the Second Amendment. Derry says, my grandfather in his 80s killed himself with a hunting rifle. He felt his body going and he didn't want to be a burden or go into a nursing home. And Class A wrote, let's emphasize our agreements instead of our disagreements. Everyone wants to prevent suicides by people in a temporary psychological crisis, and limiting access to lethal means during that time is definitely a part of that prevention. Only a part, but an important part. Daniel is with us, calling in from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Daniel. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to make the point about mental illness and gun violence, that the vast majority of those with mental illness will never be violent, and that mental illness alone accounts for only about 4% of gun deaths. And what I think is important is to focus on, if we're talking about guns as a tool, whether or not you believe that to be true, limiting access to those guns for those who might be at risk of using them to hurt themselves or others. It's important to have that debate without only focusing on mental illness, because it's a way to distract from some of the larger issues. Thank you, and I'll listen off the air.
So, Daniel, I take it that you're differentiating between a defined mental illness and somebody who's in psychological crisis.
Correct, because those with defined diagnosed mental illness, the vast majority will never be violent.
Thanks for that distinction. I appreciate you talking about that. So if we talk about someone with schizophrenia, for example, a defined mental illness, you know, Daniel's saying there are a lot of conversations that we have, Taylor, where we lump things together, and that may be one of them. You know, mental illness is sort of a catch-all phrase. Gun regulations is sort of a catch-all phrase. And so, you know, you do sort of tease these things apart as we have these conversations. Nonetheless, that question about how do you prevent somebody who's in a psychological crisis, whether you define it as a mental illness or not, how do you prevent them from having access to lethal means? And from the VPR team's data analysis, 89% of gun deaths in Vermont over that six-year period are suicides. Very, very, very huge percentage of gun deaths in Vermont attributed to suicide. Let's go to Leah, who's calling in from Bennington. Am I saying your name right? Is it Leah or Leia?
It's Leia.
Hi, Leia. Go right ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to say, to share a moment in my life when I was really, really, really down. And had there been a gun in my house, I would not be calling you. As it turned out, I took a lot of pills. And then sort of in the middle, I changed my mind. And I went to the hospital, and the physical was taken care of, and I saw a psychiatrist, and I'm fine now. The idea of committing suicide is in my past. I think that if they want to commit suicide, they'll find a way. It's not really quite true. You have no options if you use a gun. There's nothing, you can't change your mind, it's gone, you're gone. You have time if you don't have a gun. You have time for somebody to come in and talk to you. You have time to change your mind. You have time, and you don't with a gun.
Leah, I appreciate you calling in and sharing your perspective and your own experience, and I'm very glad that you were here to call us today, and thank you for sharing your thoughts and your own life with us. Let's get another perspective here from Emily, who's calling in from Winooski. Hi, Emily. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to share an experience that sort of parallels your data. And over the course of the past 7 years, my husband, who, we're just normal, average people, he's been on the scene in harm's way for two public and or mass shootings. The first one, he was a grad student at the University of Texas at Austin, and he was studying in the library for an exam, and a gunman walked through. Everyone evacuated. He wound up just taking his own life. So that was in 2010. And then just this past winter, my husband accompanied the UVM swim team on their training trip to Florida and was at the Fort Lauderdale airport. And thankfully, he was not in, direct harm's way, but it was a very stressful, several hours trying to reach him and, because there were rumors of a second gunman. And so I just wanted to add that layer, even in this day and age, you think, you never know, I guess.
Emily, thanks for sharing your perspective, and I'm sorry to hear about the circumstances that your husband found himself in and how traumatic that has been for you and for your family. Taylor, in a lot of cases here in Vermont and elsewhere around the country, people hold what might seem like opposing views within themselves. We know and have heard from Vermonters who say, I'm a hunter, I own guns, but I also have a family member or a close friend who has committed suicide, or I have been the victim of a gun crime, but I also own guns for self-defense. Or, there are sort of very, very many layers to this that we've found. How do you hope that the reporting that has been done in gunshots by a whole large team at VPR can be used by all kinds of people and sort of moved forward?
Well, I guess I hope that the realities of guns in Vermont are more clear to people to understand. And I mean, really, I just hope that people are more willing to accept those seemingly conflicting realities as they, as you talk to somebody, maybe they say they hunt and they love to go hunting and target shooting, but they do want some form of gun control. And before you stomp on them as, contradicting themselves, like, just hear that out. And on the other side, if somebody says, they want the right to 3D print their own AR-15 at home, hear them out about like why they want to do that and what they see as a legitimate use for that, because there's so much that is that is going on here in terms of the death data itself, but also in terms of what we've heard from around Vermont. Just we heard the story of one gentleman who his father is a Muslim immigrant, and he said that he has no problem with guns. He's been in Vermont for quite a while. But after President Trump took office sometime in April, and he associates this with President Trump taking office, his father received a death threat. And now he's thinking about maybe it is time to own a gun. And that is, you know, not the sort of the story you hear about guns in Vermont. And so I'm just hoping that people will become more open to what is the story of guns in Vermont and how do we make that story have the best possible outcomes, whatever the path to those outcomes is.
Well, there's a lot to find in the data. You can find it all at vpr.net. It's our Gunshots series. Taylor Dobbs was the producer of the series, but as you'll see when you go to vpr.net, there is a whole long list of people who were involved, who did reporting, who did some of the work on the death certificates, many volunteers. And one thing before we leave, Taylor, is we've talked quite a bit about how the majority of gun deaths in Vermont are suicides. And there's a lot of resources at vpr.net for people who may feel that they are in crisis or know who someone who is. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline number is 800-273-8255. Again, that's 800-273-8255. We have many more resources at vpr.net in the Gunshot series. Taylor, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Happy to.